Good morning. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It's 9 a.m. sharp on March 13th, 2007. Today, with us, we have Senator Hoffman, Senator Huggins, Senator Thomas, Senator Elton, and Senator Olson was just in and out. He'll be back here momentarily. We've got three items on today's agenda. We've got Senate Bill 59 concerning radio and television advertising to promote charitable gaming. We'll deal with that bill first, and then we'll go to Senate Bill 81, extending the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives. And then HB 18, we're going to have another hearing on amending the powers of the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education regarding the WAMI Medical School Program, which is the Alaska version of medical school. I'd like to go ahead and start with Senate Bill 59 concerning radio and television advertising to promote charitable gaming. The intent here today is to move this bill unless we have a logistical issue coming forward with it. My office has worked with the sponsor, Senator Stevens, along with the Senate President, on a Finance Committee substitute. And Senator Huggins.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the CS for Senate Bill 59, Version C.
Okay. Hearing no objections. On the table is SB 59, Version C, as our working document. And everybody has that in their packet. And with us at the end of the table, already coming forward knowing the process of the table here, is a representative from Senator Stevens' office, Doug Letch. And then online, do we happen to have Jake Libby? Yeah. Okay. And online, we have Jake Libby from Palmer. I'd like to go ahead and welcome Mr. Letch, if you could please carry forward.
Sure. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and good morning, members of the Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Doug Letch. I'm a staff to Senator Gary Stevens, and I'm here to talk about the portion of the new bill that you have before us that relates to the use of broadcasting to promote raffles and lotteries. For questions on the other part of the bill, which would be the Palmer Cabbage Classic, a representative from Senator Green's office, Darwin Peterson, is also here, and I think he can address that portion of the CS as well. As the chairman mentioned, he's been working with the two offices to meld these two ideas together into this bill. The parts of SB 59 that I'd like to talk about, of course, being the broadcasting one, what we're hoping to do is to level the playing field for Alaska broadcasters. As you may know, currently, the statute prohibits broadcasters from airing truthful and non-misleading advertisements of lawful charitable gaming activity. And because of this, folks that are involved in various community organizations, whether it be your local Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts or perhaps senior centers, football leagues, little leagues, et cetera, aren't allowed to use radio and television to advertise their raffles, things like that, but they can do so in the media. The statute also may impede positive governmental interests because Alaska Broadcasting Association member stations won't be able to assist nonprofit organizations in their efforts to raise fundraising through these goals. And it may deny broadcasters equal protection under the federal and state constitution, since the Act prohibits, without rational basis, the broadcast media from engaging in conduct allowed by the print media, namely the carriage of third-party advertising promoting charitable gaming activities. And you've seen the sponsor statement that we included with the package, the example of the Boy Scouts not being able to advertise their raffles. And I can tell you, as a former radio newscaster, McGrath, Dillingham, Valdez, Kodiak, I'm an advocate for broadcasting. And as a member of various community organizations over the years, one of the things that we ran into was the need to do advertising for our raffles, try and get the word out. The small raffles, the $5, $10 type raffles there and there, those ones are kind of easy. You sit at a grocery store or whatever, but you get into the bigger ones, like, for example, the Football League in Kodiak that I helped found. We do a $100 raffle for the Super Bowl. That one's a little harder to reach people on, and it takes some advertising dollars. And in Kodiak, which is served by one newspaper and a few radio stations, the ability to reach out with the radio and reach a larger audience would be greatly beneficial to an organization like that. So from my perspective and from my time in broadcasting, I think it's a great idea to move forward on something like this. And I know we have members of the organization of Alaska Broadcasters Association online who can talk to this in particular, and Mr. Dennis Egan's also here in the audience. I can answer more specific questions for you. I'd be happy to entertain any questions you might have as well. Thank you.
On page 2, section 5, there's limiting it to the Cabbage Patch at the Alaska State Fair in Palmer, under the Palmer Rotary Club. And you kind of explain why that type of verbiage is required in the bill and the intent of it.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn that question over to Darwin Peterson from Senator Green's office.
Okay. If Mr. Peterson would come forward. You could go ahead and identify yourself and who you represent or work for.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Darwin Peterson. I'm staff to the Senate President's office. To answer your question, Mr. Chairman, Section 5, that language was selected as a policy call by the Senate President working with the Palmer Rotary Club on this language. If you look in that section of statute, when they go through and they list the different classics that are allowed in statute for charitable events, a lot of them do specify the venue and who will administer the classic. Like the Kenai River Classic, for example, the Kenai Chamber of Commerce is listed in statute as the organization that will administer it. So it doesn't have to be limited specifically to the Alaska State Fair or to the Palmer Rotary Club. The Palmer Rotary Club is the organization that has historically managed this contest at the Alaska State Fair, and that's where it's always been held. So the Senate President decided that it would be consistent with the rest of that section of statute to place that in the bill. But it is a policy call by the committee. If the committee chooses to delete Alaska State Fair and Palmer and the Palmer Rotary Club, that is an option, and the classic will still be able to continue, but it will also be allowed to occur in other areas of the state. The Matanuska Valley and the Palmer State Fair is really the only place in the state, though, that does do this kind of activity.
Okay. Mr. Jake Libby, is he online?
Yes, I am, sir.
Do you have anything you'd like to add to that, Mr. Libby, after you identify yourself for the record?
For the record, my name is Jake Libby. I'm the current president of the Palmer Rotary Club. The only thing that I would add to it is that it makes sense to have it identified with the Alaska State Fair. There's already a tremendous amount of press that's actually nationwide in regards to the Giant Cabbage Weigh-Off, which is what this particular fundraiser is tied to. I don't see any real problem with opening it up other places, but it makes more sense to tie it to the Giant Cabbage Weigh-Off at the State Fair, because that's when the cabbages come into their, that's when they're ready for culling. That's what all the press is related about, and that's the reason why we've always done it at the State Fair. And I would just ask the committee to consider that in their decision, because there's very little other opportunity to have a cabbage classic. So it just makes sense to tie that verbiage in with the bill.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure who to go ahead and ask this question of, but it seems to me that the flavor that I'm getting is that youth organizations in general are not able to go ahead and participate in charitable events. As we look at Section 3, we've got a number of exceptions there, but I'm assuming there's some kind of prohibition for this from a statewide level that disallows charitable events. I wonder why that is.
Through the Chair, Senator Olson, it's policy call of the state that this type of gambling has always been curtailed and closely managed. So it has to be listed specifically in statute the type of charitable event that you're going to allow. So other charitable events are allowed, but they do have to be specifically listed in statute.
Mr. Chairman, one last question, if I could. So there is a difference between a raffle and outright gambling?
Yes. Yep. If the proceeds go to charity.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'd like the record to reflect that Senator Dyson has arrived. Senator Elton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just this is a drafting question, but it seems to me that if we've got Section 5 that limits Cabbage Classic to one Cabbage Classic, that in Section 3 we ought to have the singular under Cabbage Classic instead of Cabbage Classics. Is that correct?
Through the Chair, Senator Elton, yes, that's a good catch.
Mr. Chair, I just recommend an amendment on page 2, line 10, that we make Cabbage Classic singular instead of plural.
We have an amendment to do a verbiage cleanup. Do you have any objection? For me?
It's on 3 pages, section 2.
The amendment is to remove on page 2, line 10, make the word classics singular, drop the S on the end.
Mr. Chair, if I could amend it, my colleague across the table has noted that Cabbage Classics is mentioned in Section 1, also Section 2 and Section 3. So I would amend the amendment to just make Cabbage Classic wherever it appears, Cabbage Classics wherever it appears. The amendment would be to make it Cabbage Classic singular.
Hearing no opposition, amendment passes. We have any other questions from the committee? Do we have anybody that would like to speak to this issue? We have Scott Smith.
Yes, present.
Okay. If you could identify yourself, please.
My name is Scott Smith. I'm the current president of the Alaska Broadcasters Association. And I'd like to reiterate just a few remarks that have already been made regarding the local broadcasters' desire to better serve our communities, particularly as it comes to charitable fundraising in many forms. At this point in time, commercial broadcasters are prohibited from mentioning in any way local raffles that may be designed to help fundraise for nonprofits or faith-based organizations, or in many cases, well-known events such as an Nana Ice Classic. And my constituents, or rather my membership, would just like to urge that we get this misguided law adjusted so that we can help promote and do the outreach for these types of events in order to assist in the fundraising efforts done by these organizations.
Okay, thank you. And Bob Kern.
Yes, sir.
If you could please identify yourself and make the comments that you'd like to make, please.
Okay, thank you very much. My name is Bob Kern. I'm president of TLP Communications Incorporated in Ketchikan. We operate KFMJ radio, and we also publish the local paper here in Ketchikan. I'm also a member of the Alaska Public Broadcasting Commission. I'm not speaking on behalf of the commission, but I do feel personally that legislation, Senate Bill 59, would favorably impact the 26 public radio and TV stations that the APBC oversees and would allow those stations to help nonprofit groups and organizations in promoting their activities in their communities. I feel that passage of this legislation would not only free stations to assist local nonprofit organizations in their fundraising efforts, it would also eliminate a huge amount of confusion that exists between Alaska and the other states in the union and FCC regulations. Alaska is one of two states where stations are not able to broadcast gaming or lottery announcements. If nothing else, this legislation is needed to bring Alaska into line with the rest of the United States. Locally, a local radio station here in town and the American Diabetes Association ran afoul of state and federal statutes. And basically, I have a letter here from the FCC that states basically that they would not prosecute or fine the station because ADA had a gaming permit from the state and said that the raffle was apparently not in violation of FCC regulations. So in the meantime, the rest of us broadcasters are sitting around saying, well, you know, the FCC is saying one thing, the state is saying something else, and we really need to get this clarified so that everybody knows exactly what the rules and regulations are. In other words, what's legal in Denver, for instance, and legal to broadcast and upload to a satellite in Denver is not broadcast here in the state of Alaska. And stations every day are running into that kind of situation. Cable systems, for instance, around the state are broadcasting illegally lottery information from, say, WGN in Chicago as they broadcast the lottery information there. And I think it really needs to, the law really needs to be clarified so that everybody knows exactly where they stand on this issue. Not only that, but also to allow local radio stations in the state to assist organizations such as Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and Little League organizations to promote their fundraising activities. Thank you very much for your consideration, and I really hope that you pass this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Kern. That's everybody online. Mr. Dennis Egan, come forward here and put your name on the record and who you represent and if you support or don't support.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dennis Egan. I'm President General Manager of Alaska General Communications, past President of the Alaska Broadcasters Association, and also a board member of the Alaska Broadcasters Association. I'd like to thank the committee for affording us the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 59. Senate Bill 59 affords a solution to the disparate treatment that is currently being imposed on Alaska's broadcasters by current Alaska statute. Alaska statute prohibits, but only by way of radio and television, the advertising of lawful charitable gaming or conduct. Newspapers and related media are free to advertise the very same activity and conduct that radio and TV stations may not advertise. Recognizing the unfair burden placed upon broadcasters, Congress passed the Charity Games Advertising Clarification Act of 1988. It's been in effect since 1990. Congress opened the door for broadcasters to advertise for charity, not to conduct charitable gaming. The new federal law left it up to the individual states to ratify the federal law, and to this date, nearly every state has allowed broadcasters in their respective states to become fully consistent with the federal law. Under the Charity Games Advertising Act signed into law by President Reagan in 1988, federal law prohibits the acceptance of any advertising from a business whose primary purpose is the conducting of a gaming activity, charitable or otherwise. Alaska's broadcasters feel that being allowed to announce that a local volunteer fire department is having a raffle to raise funds for CPR equipment, or the senior center is selling tickets on an afghan to raise funds for the senior citizen caravan, or the local high school is raising funds to pay for travel for sporting activities throughout the state, is not detrimental to anyone. Alaska's broadcasters are not trying to suggest to you what activities should be permissible in the state. What we are asking is that all media, including print, electronic, direct mail, even the signs we see on municipal buses, have the same ground rules when it comes to promotion. Congress recognized this inequity with the passage of the Advertising Charitable Games Advertising Clarification Act. As a federal licensee, broadcasters are one of the most highly regulated industries in the United States, and we urge you to provide equity and give your favorable consideration of Senate Bill 59. And thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is it true what Mr. Kern just spoke about, that Alaska is only one of two states that allows essentially blanket charitable events being advertised?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, that is correct. Thank Alaska you. Is one of two states.
I'd like to have everybody turn off their cell phones.
It's not mine, Mr. Chair.
I know, I forgot to mention that in the beginning. Power them off would be appreciated. Hearing no questions, more questions for Mr. Egan. Thank you for your testimony.
You.
And Mr. Litch, if you can come forward to the hot seat again. I'm going to talk about your fiscal note a little bit. It looks like the fiscal note may need to be modified in that wouldn't there be some fee revenue generated from these licenses?
Mr. Chairman, are you referring to that portion of the fee license from the part that would deal with the Cabbage Classic?
Correct. Looks like we need to delete the last line in the second paragraph under the analysis and have the Department of Revenue make some minor changes to this and then have it catch back up to the bill.
That's, Mr. Chairman, that sounds like the wise thing to do.
Okay. Do we have any further questions or comments from any committee members? Okay. Hearing none, Senator Huggins, would you please make a motion?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that CS for Senate Bill 59, version Charlie, as amended, with individual comments, the attached physical note to be revised, be moved.
We have a motion on the table, and we hear objections. No objections. We'll go ahead and move the bill forward to the next committee of referral, and we'll see that the fiscal note is modified. We'll take a brief at ease.
lives until June 30th, 2015, in accordance with the recommendations of the legislative auditor. The legislative audit has concluded that the Board of Certified Direct Entry and Midwives meets all the statutory requirements of public need, is in compliance with the statutes which requires occupational licensing fees to cover the regulatory cost of that occupation. The board serves as a means to make people practicing midwifery aware of the level of experience and education expected of them, and it consists of five members appointed by the governor. Their duties include examining and certifying applicants, permitting apprentices, holding hearings, and ordering disciplinary actions. They maintain all the educational records, approved curricula, training, and programs for the direct entry midwives and apprentices. And they have worked proactively to ensure that public safety has been maintained while improving the profession of midwives. They have successfully incorporated certified professional midwife standards into Alaska's certified direct entry midwives licensing program, and worked with the state to establish Medicaid procedures for CDM services, thereby placing Alaska among eight states which both license their traditional midwives and provide Medicaid reimbursement for their services. And they continue to work to create and revise regulations that ensure the proper training and increase educational requirements. In your packet, if I may, there's a statement from Kay Connie, who's the executive director of the Juneau Family Birth Center. She couldn't be with us this morning. Approximately 10% of all the births in Alaska are done through direct entry midwives and midwives in the United States. And this, they also, for the record, have the highest fee of any occupational licensing group in the state. It's over $2,000 per person. And with that, I'd ask for your support of this bill.
Okay. If we could go to, in the report, if we can go to page 17, which is the blue covered report. A letter from Dana Brown, the certified direct entry midwife chair, and then two-thirds of the way down in that paragraph, she's referring to a glitch in that there may need to be some statute changes. And could you address that, or do you want me to be more specific in the
question? I need to be more specific, sir.
Okay. This paragraph indicates that there's a desire by the board to change certification requirements for apprentice direct entry supervisors, and that current statutes are preventing them from doing that. And is there any legislation being pursued then by the board to go ahead and change that? If we can just go to an at ease, please.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, I am not aware of that specific statute change, or excuse me, regulatory change that they are discussing in the letter.
Okay. Do we have any questions from the Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Benavides, how many number of licensees do you have in the state of Alaska?
I defer that to Pat Davidson. She's here from Legislative Audit. She probably knows those numbers. If I may.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Pat Davidson, representing the Division of Legislative Audit. The current number of licensees, there are 28, well, as of the end of fiscal year 06, there were 28 midwives and 8 apprentices.
Mr. Chairman, if I can continue.
Go ahead.
Number of births that they've attended to in the last year?
I do not have that information.
So. Do you have any history of how many bad outcomes they've had during this last year as well?
Through the chair, Senator Senator Olson, I don't have that information directly. During the course of the audit, what we do is we look at the effectiveness of the investigations and the timeliness of the investigations. And what we found there were that the investigations were primarily occurring in a timely manner and being resolved.
Mr. Chairman, if I can continue.
Senator Olson.
Any disciplinary action against these licensees over the last year?
Through the chairman, Senator Olson, I'm reading on page 10 of the report, I'm sorry. It doesn't talk about which actions have been taken. If there's a member of the board, they might have that information for you.
Okay, over the history of the board since 1992, has there been any disciplinary action done where a licensee was either put on suspension or had their license revoked?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I don't have that information. I could work with the division to get it.
If you would, please, two further questions, Mr. Chairman. One, are they able to prescribe medication at all?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I do not know that answer.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, my knowledge on the direct entry of the midwives in the state is that they cannot practice unless they're within a certain amount of miles of a practicing physician. So they also cannot take cases where the births are considered to be any type of problems. They have to. They have a rigid structure that they have to follow as far as whether or not if there's any kind of situation where it could be a difficult birth, they are not allowed to go forward. They're supposed to turn that case over to a doctor. And I do know that the last disciplinary action that occurred was for somebody who was practicing without a license. And that was the last thing. As far as him having anybody that's been taken out of service for any reason, I'm not aware of that. And I have had extensive conversations with members of the board, and that has not come up.
Okay, last question, Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Sure, go ahead.
Is the continuing medical education requirements that the midwifery board has prescribed, what are they, and have they been increasing over the last number of years, or have they changed over the last number of years, like the medical board has?
I can't speak to through the chair, Senator Olson. I can't speak to the exact things. I was hoping that Ms. Connie would be here, but she was here yesterday, but she might not have been able to get here this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Pat, maybe you could answer that question on page 17 of the letter. That earlier question about
Mr. Chairman, I don't have enough information to adequately answer your question on that one. When we review these boards for their activity, one of the things we look at is, can they carry out their own business? And making recommendations to the legislature, working through statutory change, is one of those things that we consider their responsibility. In looking to extend the board, we had found that developing regulations, formulating issues. So while I don't know what this one is about in particular, that is something that we typically look at from a board. Can they carry out all those functions?
Can we go to page 9 of the report? In the fiscal note, along with the discussion, it looks like there's a cumulative deficit running forward. And the last sentence on page 9, it says, following that period, the division should reevaluate the need for a fee change to ensure occupational fees are set to avoid an operational surplus or deficit. Could you address the financial condition of the board?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. On exhibit 1 of page 9 of the report, what we're looking at is the schedule of revenues and expenditures for the board. The easiest way to look at that is first a recognition that licenses are paid on a two-year basis. So for this board, the main licensing fees come in the odd number of years. That licensing revenue plus whatever small amounts they get in the subsequent year should be enough to carry the board forward. In fiscal year 2003, the fee being paid by the licensees was $1,350 every 2 years. In fiscal year 2005, that increased because of the deficit to $2,088. And so what you see at the end of the fiscal year of the even years, which would be the end of that two-year cycle, the cumulative deficit has been reduced from $45,000 down to $24,000. And we expect, because those fees were the same in 2007, that we will see a continued reduction in that surplus. If you look at the expenditures of the board, you'll see a spike in 03 and 04 in contractual that typically comes from investigations and the involvement of the Department of Law in investigations. And so they were high during those 2 years, and it has gone back down. And so looking at that fee structure, absent anything else, we expect that by the end of fiscal year 08, the board should be close to a zero balance moving forward. That being the case, if they maintain that level of expenditures, then your fees are going to reduce, because the fees as they exist right now are trying to cover for a previous deficit.
There's some discussion in the report concerning high litigation costs.
Yes.
And do you feel that they're being properly addressed by the budget and the board?
Through the chair, occupational boards must be self-financing, and therefore when investigations come up, when legal costs are incurred in the case of investigations, or legal costs if they're drafting regulations or recommending statutory changes, those will all increase those costs. And there's nothing that we saw that would cause us any particular concern with regard to those costs. Any board this small is always going to have a high fee. And so as we look at the direct entry midwives, our only long-term concern about the board is whether they will continue to be able to financially support the board. Okay. But so far, they have been able to.
Do you have any questions? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. on that same page, the expenses in 03 and 04 for personal services and contractual expenses were quite a bit larger than they were in 05 and 06. Can you tell me a little bit what those expenses were? Are those the legal fees, et cetera? Is that what, and what might have caused those to be so much higher in that, at that point in time, particularly in 04?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, with regard to the contractual costs, those would be the cost of legal fees involving investigations. With regard to the personal services costs, that one I can't directly address. I'm not sure, but we did, given the major swings in the contractual line, we did look at those, and that's what they were relating to.
Do we have any
just one other. The on the next page, page 10, it talks about the period of time July in the middle of the paragraph, middle of the page, anyhow, for the period July 02 through 06, division opened 9 investigations, and it indicates below what they were, but it doesn't tie those to any particular year. You have information on which those were? I'm just trying to relate those back to the potential expenses and see if any of them are still ongoing, and we would expect that that those legal fees may still be up in, say, the 07.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, I don't have that information directly. The fees depend upon where the case goes, not as much as that there was a case opened, but the extent to which investigations have been done and to the extent that the Department of Law has to become involved in this situation. Investigations and legal fees are just, they're a concern to many of the boards because of anything that makes occupational licensing fees swing significantly from one biennium to the next. It tends to be those type of fees. However, the boards are required to be financially self-sufficient, and however, they also need to you know, deal with the costs of the investigations and any resulting Department of Law charges as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman. Senator Elton and Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And back to the Chairman's questions about the letter from the Board Chair on page 17, where the Board Chair says that they were unable to change regulations that would increase certification requirements for apprentice direct entry supervisors. And then I would refer you to page 12. The last paragraph, it says the board is solely responsible for drafting regulations to carry out laws governing the practice of direct entry midwife. The board makes final licensing decisions, et cetera. But it does seem that there's some cognitive dissonance here, where the board chair is saying they can't do regulations, and the audit report says that they're solely responsible for drafting regulations to carry out the laws. And I favor this. I mean, I favor the board. I mean, any board or any profession that's responsible for at least 10% of the deliveries in the state of Alaska obviously needs this. And I know that the members of the profession have not complained about the size of their financial donation. But so I'm prepared to move ahead with the bill today. But it would be nice if you could get back to the committee about this. I mean, you're finding that they're solely responsible for drafting regulations and the board complaining that they can't draft regulations. It would be interesting to know what the problem is, to see if there's a follow-up needed here.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, I will have a discussion with the board chairman about that. I think in this case, they cannot draft the regulation because they don't have statutory authority to do so. What we're looking at, and we talk about, they are responsible for the promulgations of their regulations. That is within their statutory authority. Okay. And so I think what the board chairman is talking about is they want to move someplace in their regulations, but aren't currently allowed to do so because there isn't statutory authority to do so.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Elton. Any other questions? Oh, excuse me, Senator Huggins, you were next.
Yeah, same thing, Mr. Chair. Pat, going to page 10. I'm just looking at approximately 67% of the cases were filed by the peer review committee, 22% by government agencies, 11% by patients. Is there a message in that? Patients aren't complaining, but peers are, or governmental agencies are. What is there a message there?
Through the chairman, Senator Huggins, is there a clear message there? Probably not. One of the things that we look at is if that were switched, if 99% were coming in from patients, and things about the peer review committee and governmental agencies, those tend to be they didn't. Let's say more administrative. They didn't. They put in an application and didn't have all the information. Or no, I guess there's no real clear. The easiest thing to say is there's no real clear message coming through on those.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator Huggins. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One last question about the high fee schedule that you've got for them, up over $2,000. Is there any chance of any relief for that in sight, so we can encourage more people to go on into midwifery, or to maintain the people that are there, so that midwives are a nice alternative for those physicians out there that can't afford the malpractice insurance for practicing obstetrics?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, given the current structure and statute about occupations needing to be financially self-sufficient, there really is no way to address that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions from the committee, we have no one online. Do we have anybody in the room that would like to speak to this issue? Okay. Do we have any closing comments from any of the committee members and or sponsor?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, As I've been thinking about some of the questions, I recall in the last hearing that I was at, one of the midwives did state about, she made a comment about the fee, saying that they gladly pay it because they love their job and they have no problems with being certain that their profession is watched over by, you know, by the board. They also, I think I can speak, I'm going to go out on a limb here. There are two different regulations that have been published in the last month or so that deal with direct entry midwives that have to do with reimbursement and for facility fees. And so that might be part of the regulations they're talking about. They did go through a period of public comment, and those regulations didn't go through for some strange reason. They were pulled back, and a new public comment period was opened up approximately 2 weeks ago for a new set of regulations that deal with direct entry midwives. So it may be those two particular regulations that they're speaking of in this letter.
Okay, thank you. Okay, hearing nothing further, Senator Huggins, do you have a question and then maybe a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. And I don't know much about this other than I know it exists, but Senator Olson made a comment that sort of spurred my thought process of doctors can't afford to do it. Midwife kinds of people, just to summarize what I think he said, can do it because they have a lower profile of suit, I suppose. That's an interesting paradigm where the least, pardon the term, the least qualified, probably the highest risk, has the lowest profile in the legal system. Is that what you said?
Well, no, certainly that's not what I said. Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Yes, go ahead, Mr. Senator Olson.
That's not what I said, with all due respect to what you say. Now, let me just give you my comment that there are some very well-trained midwives out there that will match up against any obstetrician that's out there. Obviously, they don't have the surgical capabilities, so you can't jump to a C-section right away, but there are some excellently trained and very well-experienced midwives that are out there, and I would trust my wife to them if we were delivering.
I have full confidence that they're qualified. I guess that would lead to my question, is what sort of insurance do they have to carry?
Go ahead.
And I'm not saying they need insurance. That's the question that came to mind.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I do not know. I'm sure they do. But as I stated earlier, because of the way the laws are structured in the state of Alaska, they are not allowed to take part in high-risk pregnancies, which would come into play, that type of high insurance costs.
Senator Olson, you have a comment in closing?
Well, in normal circumstances, a midwife is usually under the umbrella or in with an organization that has a group insurance, and so because of the malpractice issues is addressed from the group standpoint, as well as I think some of the fees are also addressed from the standpoint of the corporation or the group that they work with.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This discussion has highlighted a policy issue that we probably need to take up at some point. With our decision sometime past that all of these boards should be self-sufficient, as in their fees covering their expenses, we've put in an adverse incentive for them to do a good job of policing their own members. And so when they do, it often results in litigation that then drives up their fees for it and makes it a disincentive for them to do the very job of supervising their members. It is most clear in the mental health boards that the ones that have prosecuted the most cases against their members have indeed the highest fees, and have new people who are considering which board to get licensed under are choosing to stampede to the other board that they could qualify under, and therefore reducing the number in the board that may be the one that's being the most diligent. And I think it's an issue that we should take up sometime because it's not having our effect, the right effect.
Okay, that about wraps it up. Senator Huggins, could you make a motion, please, to move the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate Bill 81, I would attach physical note to individual comments, be moved from committee.
Okay, we have a motion to move the bill with the attached physical notes and individual recommendations. Do we have objection? Seeing no objection, we'll go ahead and move Senate Bill 81 onto the next committee of referral. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. Come back on the record. We're going to go on to HB 18, which is our last and final bill today. It's amending the powers of the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education regarding the WAMI medical school program, which is the de facto state of Alaska medical school. We're going to here's some added information today concerning this bill. We will not be moving this bill forward today, but we may have some more questions at the end of the day, and we're working on some fiscal issues with this particular item. And I see coming forward was Mr. Mike Palowski, staff of Representative Kevin Meyer, who's a sponsor of the bill. Mr. Palowski, if you could go ahead and introduce yourself and who you represent, and then lead into possibly answering the questions that were asked at the last meeting, would be appreciated, and then we'll go from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mike Palowski, and I'm an aide for Representative Meyer. At the last hearing, there were two substantive questions that were asked, and I believe we turned in a memo in writing to your office, Mr. Chairman. The first question was, what is the long-term effectiveness of the WAMI program? Essentially, how many WAMI graduates are still practicing in Alaska? Looking backwards towards 1975, when the program started, we can say that 60% of all WAMI graduates are still practicing in Alaska today. That was the first question. The second question was, how many WAMI graduates practice in Bethel or out in rural Alaska? While WAMI graduates have previously practiced in Bethel in the Western Alaskan region, there are none currently practicing there. Students have, however, been accepted from the area, and students from rural Alaska represent a significant portion of the incoming WAMI classes, something that Alaska is quite proud of. And it does get difficult when you start to define urban and rural, is that out of the 60% of WAMI graduates practicing in Alaska, almost one in four are currently practicing in a rural community. That compares to 1 in 10 in the other states that participate in the program. The other substantive question was related from Senator Elton to the amendment made in the Senate Special Committee on Education that allowed interest to accrue during a student's residency. That was a policy call made. The question was, does allowing interest to occur discourage people from going into general family practice? And when I talked to the sponsor about it, in looking at it, there's some argument that it does, but since that's speculating on a person's professional decisions, it's a little bit more difficult. What we did say is that you certainly have substantially increased the debt burden on a student, which, since it gets repaid when you come back to Alaska, has increased the incentive someone has to return here to practice. And that was the debate in the Senate Special Committee on Education. Mr. Chairman, those were the essential questions that were asked at the last hearing. I'm available and happy to answer further questions from the committee, and if I can, direct the committee to the appropriate people that should be online or in the audience to answer your other questions.
I'd like the committee members just to notice that in the packet there was a submittal by Senator Olson that he had brought forward the last meeting, but the chair held that till we could get it labeled and titled. That is included in your packet. Do we have any questions of this sponsor? Let's go ahead and move to the online and hear from Mr. Risk, is that right, from the University of Alaska? Am I pronouncing that name correctly?
Yeah, it's Rizik, and I'm just available for if there's any questions on the fiscal note.
Okay, we'll get into that in a minute.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Mike Hogan from the AKPS, which I'm certainly is not the Alaska Purseiners.
No, it's Alaska Physicians and Surgeons, Senator, and I'm here also just to answer questions and just to support the bill.
Okay. Mr. Pete Kelly, do you have anything?
Not here to testify, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We're working off handwritten scripts today instead of our forms. So, Diane Barron? Okay. Everybody's a little shy today. So let's move on into the fiscal note. That seems to be one of the issues of major concern. The cost of the program to the state and the potential impact in years to come. And if we could back up, Michelle Risk, maybe you'd like to respond to the cost implications that we appear to be facing if we implement this in the operating funds of the state.
Okay, first, Mike, did you pass out the revised fiscal note that we had submitted to you?
We have several fiscal notes here.
Okay.
Got the revised. I would say the answer is probably yes.
Okay, so it should have the general fund commitment for FY08 of $180,000?
Correct.
Okay. So that is the general fund commitment for FY08, and then you can see on there the outgoing years. And that, so I guess if there's any questions on the fiscal note, I could address those.
Well, the sheer magnitude of the fiscal note and if any of these costs could be absorbed within the current organization, or if there's no flexibility in this fiscal note at all?
Yes, and so the capacity that we have to contribute to the program is under the university receipts, and we would be contributing $150,000 in FY08.
Okay. Do we have any questions? Senator Elton.
A question for Michelle. Michelle, under your fiscal note, your revised fiscal note, you show travel at $30,000 a year. Mm-hmm. I mean, what is that travel?
And it's important to understand with the travel, too. It seems like, you know, because we say on here it's for the two new faculty positions and the related support costs with the associated support staff. When the program goes from 10 to 20 students, all of the existing staff, too, it will cover everyone's increased travel costs. And what that travel is for the people to, the faculty to travel to other sites, other WAMI sites.
And if I could follow up.
Sure.
And the purpose, Michelle, of the travel to other WAMI sites would be, and if I understood you correctly, you're talking about two additional staff members. And
two faculty, yes.
And so the purpose of travel to other WAMI sites would be?
They just go and learn about the program at the other. Dennis, are you online from UAA?
I am online.
Okay, do you want to speak some more about that?
With the chair's permission.
You go ahead and please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Dennis Valenzino, and I'm the director of the Alaska WAMI program at the University of Alaska Anchorage. The increased costs here are to cover two faculty who we would need to teach the additional students. Our faculty are actually functioning in a collaborative medical school. WAMI is really a collaboration amongst the five states. So the faculty to get together at least yearly to discuss how they'll present the curriculum at each site. Has to be consistent at all the sites because there are common exams to ensure that for accreditation purposes, the same material is being mastered at all sites.
If I could follow up, Mr. Chair, at least yearly sounds to me like one trip.
Well, there is always a trip at the end of the school year. There are additional trips during the year that may occur depending on what the needs are for the curriculum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Could you maybe address a little bit in the House? They called for two full-time and two part-time, and now the revised version is for two full-time. Could you clarify that a little bit more for us again, please?
Sure. Through the chair, this is Michelle Rizik. We had just put the wrong for two part-time. It's actually for existing staff, but just to increase their hours. So it's two full-time, two full-time faculty, and then the two existing part-time staff to increase their hours. So it's not two additional part-time and two additional full-time. It's just increasing the hours of the existing part-time.
Okay, and then how much of the personal service line is used for the full-time positions, or do you have a breakdown on that, or any feel for that?
Yeah, the part-time people is around 40,000 of it, and the remaining is for the two faculty positions, and that includes their benefits as well.
Okay. And then could you remind me again on the professors of the WAMI program, do they only teach WAMI students, or how does that work?
Chairman Dennis, could you address that question?
The faculty teach both WAMI students and undergraduate and graduate students, typically in biology or chemistry.
Okay. And could you please identify yourself again?
Sorry, this is Dennis Valenzino again, director of UAA at WAMI, or WAMI at UAA.
Okay. Do we have any other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. These two additional faculty that you're putting on, are these clinical faculty, or are these professors that are teaching basic sciences?
This is Dennis Valenzino again. One would be a full-time basic scientist. The other position will probably be split half to basic science and half to a clinical scientist.
Okay, and one further comment, just Mr. Chairman. I think some of the travel has also been in the expenses to get the students out to some of the rural sites that they've been exposed to, because I've seen some of the WAMI students come out to Nome and Barrow when I was there.
Okay. Do we have any other questions? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of quick questions. Can you comment on how many are on the waiting list right now to enter the WAMI program? And the time frame was discussed earlier about there being kind of a short time frame here to get this legislation passed based on the acceptance or the slots being held open by Washington State.
Mr. Chairman, this is Suzanne Trick from the University of Washington side of the Alaska WAMI program. Would you like me to answer that question?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. The timing, we have the 10 additional students on our waiting list, and they've already been determined to be accepted into the program. The letters of invitation for the first 10 have been sent out. And the second 10 who are on the waiting list will, we fear, go away with each succeeding day. They probably have letters of invitation from other medical schools. So the timing is an issue for us. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thanks.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. We have any other questions? Anybody want to make any comments? Okay, with that, we'll like
Mr. Chair, just a quick comment. It's not questioning the wisdom of the chair. I understand that we're going to leave this, but because there is a timing issue, I would hope that the committee would consider there may be questions on the fiscal note, and I know that I've asked a question, for example, on travel. It would seem to me that one of the ways of addressing this would be within the next couple of days moving the bill and leaving the fiscal notes aside and just dealing with this in the university's operating budget. And that, I don't know whether that would give the kind of assurance to the University of Washington that's needed so that 10 additional Alaskans could be added to the program this year. But if it would, it would seem to me that that would be beneficial to the state of Alaska to get those additional 10 people in.
Thank you, Senator Elton. There has been testimony here before on the timeline and the issuance of the need in Alaska, and particularly in rural Alaska, you know, for doctors. So we recognize that. Also, there's the timeline, and we are in the process here going through the university budget, both operating and capital, and that, as you know, is being put together in the next week or so. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess, you know, I do have some concerns about the fiscal note and possibly Senator Elton's process is a good one, but the concern that I have is that although we have a shortage of doctors in Alaska, when you look at health care and the need for health care in rural areas of the state, it far outweighs the need for the delivery of services in urban areas because of the health concerns out there. And I guess I'm interested in some language in here that gives direction to at least have some of those physicians practicing once they finish their service, practicing in rural areas of the state. The way that this is written, we can have increases in doctors, and not one single doctor with this legislation could end up in rural Alaska. And that gives me great concern, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. We're going to go ahead and just a second. Senator Olson, would you like to make a comment?
If I could, Mr. Chairman, with all due respect to my colleague from Bethel, I think that there is the concern that we do need, and I have practiced in areas that have been in desperate need of physicians. But one of the things that happens is that if you're sitting out there in one of the rural sites and you're tired and your wife is on you about maybe they want to be closer to Nordstrom's and those kind of issues that they like to engage, or those kind of activities that they like to engage in, if somebody offers you a position, it's a lot easier to accept that position, whereas if you had a fuller complement of physicians there in the metropolitan areas, those opportunities and those recruiting actions that happen from there are going to be less if you put more physicians into the rail area. And so that's the only comment I have with the idea that physicians act in rural Alaska, and there is certainly a shortage that is there. Going on to another subject, if I could, Mr. Chairman.
Briefly, go ahead.
The idea that we're under a fairly tight time frame, as was expounded by Suzanne Trick, I guess one of the thoughts that have been discussed about reducing the numbers to try and get at least 5 students into the acceptance program, and I'm certainly not making an amendment at this point, but I just want to have it considered by the committee that we try and expedite, because time is of the essence.
Thank you, Senator Olson. I'll work with you on some of your concepts. I know you've expressed interest to me about moving us forward as quickly as possible. We'll continue to work on the fiscal impact of this through the regular budgetary process and see if we, with the reference of the time frame we're under, to try to come to some kind of a conclusion. To go ahead and just set this bill aside for now, move on to the close of the meeting. If any of the members have any additional comments they'd like to make, this would go ahead and conclude the agenda for today. Okay, tomorrow morning at 7:30, which is a little early, we're going to have the University of Alaska Subcommittee on their operating budget. Again, for the public, it's a committee of the whole. So we'll meet here in this room at 7:30, and the university process will continue. This was the second meeting on that. And then following that, we'll have the full finance committee meeting. Will begin at 9:30 tomorrow. Again, that's 9:30, a half hour later than normal. We're going to hear a presentation on the public employees retirement system, the retiree reserve account, which is the issue at hand. It's been mentioned several times this year at the table, where we have some accounting difficulties that we need to clean up. So we're going to hear that presentation on the problem tomorrow, and there will be legislation coming forward to produce a solution for us to work on. And with that, I'll have to take a quick at ease. I neglected to mention that President Hamilton will be here tomorrow morning at our invitation, which is appreciated. We did move the meeting around. That's why it's a little out of sequence, to facilitate his schedule. With that, I'd like to go ahead and adjourn the meeting today and thank everybody for attending.